more than ever having conversations around what is that thing? What drives you? What is the positive moment on the outside of your work that drives you, that inspires you, that connects you to your professional life is more important than ever.
That's Suher Khan, and this is the On Design Podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the On Design Podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. I'm an illustrator, and I've also spent the past 10 years in the design industry in a variety of roles. On this podcast, every week, we speak to the most exciting people in design right now. We learn what inspires them, how they work, and how they see the world. In today's episode, I speak to Suher Khan, who's the lead of strategic projects at Google. Before that, she was heading up global projects for Google Arts and Culture. She's also the founder of Open Ended, a new platform for activism design, which gathers together a diverse community of creative practitioners. In our conversation, we discuss Suher's work at the nexus of technology, design, and art, the joy of experimentation, the role of activism in design, and what both large companies and individuals can do now to make technology that's ethical and supporting diversity. So here it is for you to enjoy.
Firstly, thank you for your time to coming on the pod, and I'm very excited about our conversation and kind of talking about quite a few things that you're involved in. But I thought we'll start with Google. And you've been at the company, I think, for about 10 years now. Is that right?
Yeah, 10 years now. Over 10 years.
Yes. Brilliant. So over a decade at Google. And I thought that it would be nice to talk about kind of how you started there, then your role as the head of Google Arts and Culture, and what you're involved in right now.
Sure. So, thank you, Justina. I'm really excited. I love your podcast, and I also, the kinds of people that you get on are all really inspiring and interdisciplinary, which I really respect. So thank you for inviting me. And we have met actually at Google in the offices in London. So I feel like it's a really nice coming full circle for the two of us to have this conversation. So I joined Google in California, as you said, over a decade ago now. I had recently finished my master's and ended up being one of those slightly accidental hires. I was studying international development. I was really interested in emerging markets and was sort of interviewing around for jobs in extremely serious, some would say quite nerdy economic research sorts of roles, and ended up having a conversation with a couple of recruiters at Google and, flying to California to Mountain View for my interviews. And, everyone was riding these little colorful bicycles around and really genuinely wearing these little caps with little helicopter wings on top of them. And it felt surreal and magical. But equally, there was this really powerful sense at the time, as you know, that something really special and very important had already happened. And as you know, Silicon Valley is really the home of technology, from an internet perspective, as we know it today. So it just made a lot of sense for me at the time to make that decision. I moved from New York, I moved to San Francisco, and started off working on a much more kind of business / strategy role, and eventually ended up, I suppose, pivoting into new business development, working with some of our original business leaders at the time who are looking at everything from the self-driving car to, other initiatives, which eventually some of them ended up being part of Google X. Others ended their lives quite early, and others have manifested into products that we know of today. And then I moved to Singapore a few years after that with an interest in emerging markets. But of course, at the same time, I'd started working with arts and culture. The team was based between London and Paris, and Amit Sood, who had founded the platform, was in London and became, you know, eventually my boss and a mentor. And after a few years in Singapore, where, you know, I can talk more about it, but I was working on an emerging markets team. I was a product manager on the business side, which is a role that we don't actually have anymore. Very different world, working on incubating and launching and experimenting with new product ideas with a particular focus on emerging markets. We looked at everything from payments to social messaging many years before, you know, Facebook bought WhatsApp. We looked at products like YouTube and video streaming in countries where at the time there was very little internet connectivity and bandwidth. And equally, we worked on access initiatives. And when we say access, we mean access to the internet, you know, across continents such as Africa and Asia. So very exciting. Like, you know, I just remember those first, you know, let's say 5-6 years at Google were years where there was constant experimentation, and I worked with some of the most inspiring people that I've ever met. They really opened up for me this idea of technology as a really hopeful, optimistic force in the world. One of my first, you know, indirect bosses, Megan Smith, ended up becoming the CTO for the Obama White House. You know, others that I've worked with have ended up starting their own companies in education for good. And of course, many have ended up across the technology world now leading organizations that have shaped the way we live and interact and connect and, you know, many would say behave and think. So it has been a really incredible journey, and I'm so grateful for something that I couldn't have imagined. And one of the things that really drew me to Google was this idea of being humble, you know, being sort of leaning into the fact that we're experimenting, we're trying our best, and whatever happens, happens. And that's a journey that's, you know, allowed me to carry through from projects that have always been experimental. I've always been on teams that are very scrappy. You know, you often have to kill things, and, you know, you have to like let things go in a way that you wouldn't if you were working on a bigger product or a product that already was established. But it has allowed me to learn from some of the world's, you know, most inspiring technologists, and also to follow my own path and to find my own voice, which in hindsight, I'm really lucky that I've been able to do, because it allowed me to work on arts and culture. It's allowed me now, of course, to work in design, to start teaching things that I wouldn't have imagined, you know, all those years ago. And of course, to maintain a connection to my own identity as somebody who's, you know, grown up in less developed parts of the world and still has an interest in the power of technology for everything from connecting us culturally, as well as to, you know, making people's lives in some ways easier or often just more fun.
So tell me about some of those projects. I'm very interested in the access projects you were working on, and also about the feeling and the process of working on projects that were very experimental, that you knew they were likely to be shelved. But what was it like, kind of the people in the atmosphere, and what kind of projects are in your mind, kind of close to your heart?
Yeah, so you never work on a project knowing it's going to be shelved. You sort of like just keep it going to work until the end of it. So one of those projects was actually a payments app, which, you know, we devised a new kind of method of mobile payments, which we piloted in Kenya and the Philippines. So frankly, I just remember many weeks and months on the ground working with everyone from financial service providers to university students to, you know, many, many meals in hotels. I remember traveling to Shenzhen in China to look at what was then called the China Droid market, where, you know, sort of the rip-off, knock-off Android phones were being basically shelled out at massive rates. And the feeling of it is always excitement and learning and growing, and what we would call at the time a healthy chaos. But I think as any company grows and becomes more organized and has to prioritize, initiatives like those are probably fewer and further in between. In terms of access, you know, the kind of work we did was really thinking about how best to connect people to the internet. So a lot of it involved thinking about how to structure the best sorts of deals with telecom providers, to think about how to provide more affordable data connectivity to people on the ground, everywhere from India to across Asia. And then a number of my colleagues at the time were working on fiber projects, where we were actually looking at building fiber networks to connect people in Africa. And then other colleagues of mine, including one that actually I hosted recently on Open Ended, Tilek Mamutov, was working on Project Loon, which was an initiative launched by Google X to bring balloons to offer internet connectivity to the world's most far-flung places. So they went from quite practical, business-minded initiatives to the very experimental, what we call the moonshots, the idea of anything is possible. And if you dream big, you can provide access and connectivity to anybody. You know, in hindsight, and for the more cynical of us, some of it might seem mad and ridiculous, particularly when you say, well, this is possibly not the way of, you know, everyone getting the internet in the future. But, you know, at the time, there was a sense that experimenting is never a bad thing. And I actually tend to continue to agree with that. But yeah, you do have to become resilient. You have to be okay with moving on to another project, being reassigned, starting again from scratch, and, you know, working with limited resources because you don't know where something is going to go to. And I do wonder now if, you know, there's a combination that's great, but also there's something quite nice about knowing that something has worked and you can continue to scale it out and build it out. And all tech organizations, I think, the ones that, you know, have grown a lot in the last 10 years are probably at a point of reassessing that. Having said that, what is amazing about Google is that, you know, we continue to invest in initiatives that don't necessarily have to make business sense. And one of them is, of course, Google Arts and Culture, where it's entirely not-for-profit. There's no advertising on the platform. We only work with not-for-profit museums and cultural institutions around the world in order to bring and document culture, art, the collections of art museums, the physical, 360 degree views of important cultural sites around the world. And we're continuing to expand and doing so with this mission of making the world's cultural information accessible to anyone, anywhere. So whilst we do still have that energy of, you know, being creative and being energetic about it, we know that we're on a path, and we, you know, eventually hope to get as much as we can manage of the world's culture online. And that's what, you know, all of my colleagues now in the Google Arts and Culture team are continuing to work on. And it's been an amazing year for people, you know, finding that even though you might be locked inside your house, you might be feeling low, you might just be seeking inspiration, and you can visit a museum virtually online. It's not the same thing, of course, but you can play around with augmented reality, you know, galleries, which showcase, you know, all of the world's Vermeer paintings in a room in augmented reality, or you can watch a VR film inside a NASA spaceship, or you could play with my favorite recently launched. There's an artificial intelligence driven, we call it an experiment, where you have a bunch of blobs developed in collaboration with an artist that create an opera at the touch of a mouse. So for me, there's a lot of joy in continuing to look at experimentation and technology and continuing to find the freedom of building for the sake of building, or building for the sake of creativity and technology. And I think it's incredible that Google is continuing to invest in initiatives like that, because, you know, they will always have their own voice. And because they're not necessarily, you know, a search product or something that we would see as scalable for a business purpose, they bring joy. And at a time where all of us need it, I think it matters more than ever.
And how many years were you at Google Arts and Culture? Because you were heading up the team, weren't you?
Yeah, so I was heading up a lot of our global projects, and also a number of different countries, including the UK, for many years. And I've been working with them for, I would say, at least let's say the last 7 years in various different capacities, including when I was working on our emerging markets products. And many years. And of course, I still work with the team. Right now, I'm working on a new project in sustainability and tech, and I'm also working on a bunch of strategic projects on the business side. But for me, the arts and culture team is, if I'm honest, where my heart will always be, because, you know, it means so much more than, a lot of other work that I feel personally I can contribute to.
So tell me about this new project that you're working on.
So I can't say too much about it. So high level, I'm working with a team where we've announced a collaboration with the World Wildlife Fund, and we're going to be building a new kind of platform to help the fashion industry to measure its environmental impact. So one of the partners that we've already announced that we're working with is Stella McCartney, but we're working with brands, both large and small, across the spectrum of design and fashion in the retail industry. And the idea is that if you're a textile manufacturer or a fashion designer, you'll be able to go on this platform and you'll be able to look at across metrics like biodiversity impact, carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, the actual environmental impact of your raw materials. And this is assuming you know where your raw materials are coming from. And the reason the team decided to look at exactly this stage of production is because 70% of the estimated impact of the fashion industry is at the raw material stage, which, you know, I find quite amazing, because you would just assume that it happens at distribution or manufacturing or packaging, but actually it's at the raw material stage. And there's an opportunity to impact, better practices on the ground, which will hopefully eventually help, everyone from cotton pickers in Bangladesh to, sheep farmers in New Zealand. But at the very least, is going to provide a new kind of information portal to anyone around the world, including to students. So, again, I know I've used the word experiment a few times. We don't know how useful or impactful this will eventually be, but we're working with, the experts of the World Wildlife Fund as our partners, and as the scientific researchers that will help to validate these processes, and we hope to make some kind of impact in the discourse on what it means to have access to information as we consider a more sustainable or at the very least a less destructive future as an option.
So my question here was, will the data information will it be available to everyone?
Yeah. So currently, anyone will be able to go online, put in, whatever they need to put in, and this information will basically be pushed out from this platform for them to do, what they want with. So what's very interesting is a lot of the bigger fashion companies already are measuring their environmental P&L, is what they call it, and this will help to slot into their existing formulas and algorithms in a way that hopefully is easy. And for those who are not, it's going to provide a set of tools and resources to figuring out how they might use this data to actually be useful to them in the decisions that they're making and the choices as they build out their organizations and think about being more aware at the very least.
Yeah, which is very interesting. And also then you have the consumer side of things.
Yeah.
Where looking at the data from the company can affect your decision.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, we don't have enough data on this right now. There's lots of startups and interesting platforms. And of course, the United Nations is doing a lot of work in this space, organizations like Textile Exchange, et cetera. But of course, let's make the assumption that most consumers are going to become more aware of their impact on the planet, no matter where they're based, if they can afford to do so. That's a huge caveat. And so, it might not shift all consumption, but those who can afford to be thoughtful, who are for whatever reason concerned about, the impact that their own choices are making, will use this as a tool to learn more. And equally, we hope that for students, it becomes a resource. If you are a fashion designer, if you're going into this field, if you're going to textile manufacturing or design, it's a new way of considering how your work might affect our planet and equally how you might be better in building your own business at understanding these things.
Mm-hmm. And when do you think you can launch the platform?
Well, we're hoping, you know, of course, it's a very strange time to make any decisions or commitments, but
yes.
We're hoping for soon.
For soon. Excellent. Yeah. So you'll keep us posted.
Yeah,
so that we can talk about it more.
Yeah.
And so we have, you know, a very interesting mix of working on business strategy and getting new products to the market. We talked about the non-for-profit aspect. We talked about sometimes culture and technology coming together to create something that's fun and that actually just helps and entertains and lifts spirits. And from that, I wanted to move to activism in design and something that you're doing outside of Google with Open Ended. Could you tell me more about when kind of you started to think about doing something or setting up an organization on your own outside of your work with Google, and kind of when do you think your interest in activism and design has really peaked?
Yeah, so, you know, it's very interesting. So I've kind of, you know, like we've discussed, I think I've been very lucky to have had the opportunities that I've had. And one of the reasons I wanted to pivot from working purely on culture to thinking about, you know, issues of, you know, business strategy or sustainability and technology was really to think about, you know, beyond creating magical moments and delighting a user, what is the power of technology in the world today, where we, of course, we've always had issues, but we seem to have many more than we've been aware of in the past. And also we seem very aware of them, partly because of technology. So I have started to feel over the last couple of years a bit of this itch of, okay, well, so what can we do? Apart from this idea that technology can make the world better, we equally know that there's a lot of questions and challenges around this, that we need to be more thoughtful than ever. We need to be more educated and more informed on what does it mean to consider diversity, to consider our impact in what we say, how we design products, how we design technologies and processes. And for that, I've been really lucky to be, you know, meeting through my work and, you know, the rest of my life, my family's, you know, in the art world, people who are already thinking about these things. So the last year I was thinking about how can I engage in this space, and I ended up teaching a class at the Architectural Association in May and June of 2020. I was invited by Eva Franch. She had introduced a new semester called Speculative Studies. So I think Jake and Dinas Chapman taught a class on art, and Shimon Bassar taught another class, you know, looking at the very early moments of COVID and the ideas around what impact it would have on design. And I taught, you know, very simply on culture and technology. Some of the things we've talked about is how we've thought over the years of how creativity and technology can engage, how we tell stories on Google Arts and Culture, how some of the creative teams at Google, including the Creative Lab teams based in New York and Australia, have thought about bringing machine learning into cultural experience, bringing virtual reality into cultural experience, and how they're looking at the future of how we experience the world through the lens of technology. And in devising a new kind of, you know, very short course, I just realized that I hadn't been connecting directly with demographics outside of my own in the way that I should have done. So, of course, I had this incredible class of 15 students, undergrads mostly, at the Architectural Association based around the world. And it was just this moment of time, you know, you can imagine, we've all been scattered to our various countries, or the idea of home became really confusing for each of us as we tried to find a safe space. And all of us just wanted to think about how to exist in a place that felt a little bit better and a little bit safer and a little bit kinder. And I hadn't considered, you know, from an academic perspective, any of these issues. And so I started to have very specific conversations with friends of mine, with colleagues, with people I'd met over the years through my work in technology, art, design, about what does it mean to be an activist today? activism is a very loaded term. And so I realize as I use it that I don't have personally a single definition for it. But I do think there's a difference between building a platform and building something that actually has, some kind of political energy behind it. And so, I'm really lucky. I have an awesome team. My boss is amazing. They were really excited about me considering setting something like this, and also really supportive of my eventually doing it outside of, a very large organization, because I did want to bring together a community of people to work on this that wasn't just me and my colleagues, but was people from different backgrounds, different professional disciplines, and most importantly, different age groups and social backgrounds. And you don't necessarily always get that in your professional space. So that's how I ended up launching, Open-Ended as a platform outside of Google. What it is right now, it's a community of creative practitioners, of technologists working from across disciplines. And our goal right now is to spotlight and connect innovators in culture, design, and technology from all around the world. Each of them will come from a very unique background. Most of them, you would say, are not people you might have heard from before. And the overarching mission-driven behind their work has some positive social or environmental impact as a conscious output of their work, how they think, and how it manifests. So, I have to say right now, that's where it stands. What I should caveat is, this is not to say that most people aren't trying to do the right thing. It's just that I feel like more than ever having conversations around what is that thing, what drives you, what is the positive moment on the outside of your work that drives you, that inspires you, that connects you to your professional life is more important than ever, because this is not a time to say, I'll do my best work, I'll build something that is great, and eventually it'll trickle down and have a positive effect on the world. I think the products and the technologies that end up being the most powerful are those that are actually thought out in a way that, you might have a goal, you might not end up at what your goal was, but you're constantly being self-aware, you're seeking, you're asking yourself questions, and you're not just taking this idea of building for scale or building for impact as a given, you're constantly questioning yourself. And now I've taught at the Architecture Association. I'm now teaching at Central St. Martin's, also in architecture, and I'll talk about that later. But I've been going back to some of the original kind of manifestos in Silicon Valley, this idea of what does it mean to scale. There's a very famous book on the idea of blitz scaling, so scaling, by Reid Hoffman. This idea of the companies in Silicon Valley that have been most successful have been the ones who have really looked at this idea of scaling in a way that was unbelievable and having these massive dreams and, throwing everything behind this idea of growing, because eventually, once you get to your goal, you have the power and the resources to do a lot of good, whatever your line of business. But the counter argument to that by, a lot of kind of entrepreneurs, including someone called Tim Sullivan, there was this really interesting debate that I encourage people to listen to in the Harvard Review of Books, HBR, was on, is scaling for the sake of scaling necessarily the right way to build a business? Do you want to end up being Uber and becoming massive and big and then dealing with questions around, the way you treat your staff, the way your CEO treats women or colleagues? Is that worth it at the end of it? How do we define value? Is value simply becoming really big and therefore having the power to make decisions? Or is value growing in a way that is thoughtful and is being thoughtful valuable in and of itself? So these are questions that I've just not had the time or the space to ask myself. And I found that by establishing Open-Ended and bringing together, on the one hand, through these kind of podcast/video conversations, and now we're going to be launching a series of design sprints with our guests. I'd love for you to join, Justina, sort of around issues of our time, where you're saying, let's bring an interdisciplinary group of thinkers. You could be a philosopher, an artist, or a technologist. We want you to come together with us to help to solve a problem, to think of prototypes for solutions. You might not all agree with one another because you're coming from very different perspectives, a very different, perhaps, value system. None of it is either right or wrong. But if you bring your own perspective, you're your own set of values, with this overarching goal of eventually having some kind of positive impact somewhere outside of just building a better business, you know, where will that take us? We might be surprised. We might build a very different kind of internet or mobile phone or social network, or maybe we end up with the same thing, but we've thought more deeply about how we're building it over time. And so very long story around why I thought creating a platform like Open-Ended, which hadn't existed before, would be a way of beginning to ask those questions and to start to understand the thought processes of people who, you know, are not your usual suspects in tech or design or art, but are thinking through the same questions in very different worlds.
And I think the beauty here is as well what you say about you don't know what results you'll arrive at all. And that's not, you know, because if you start designing with already knowing what you want to achieve, that's completely different. But if you're experimenting and, like you say, bringing people from different backgrounds together, you just don't know what you'll end up with. And that's the beauty and I think the excitement of the process.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the most exciting projects we had at Google Arts and Culture were when we would bring an artist, you know, someone like Ez Devlin or someone like Wayne McGregor, the choreographer, together with one of our creative coders at the Google Arts and Culture Lab in Paris. And we would say, well, we know that you haven't worked with technology in the past, but you're interested in it. And so Laurent Gaveau, who leads the Google Arts and Culture Lab in Paris, would just say, well, let's allow for these creative conversations to take place without a plan for where things go in the future. And what ends up happening is you start with, you know, a creative coder knowing what's possible with the existing corpus of machine learning algorithms and things that he or she has worked on in the past, and an artist with, you know, an idea around, you know, where they want their practice to go or a problem they might want to solve, or even the curator at a museum like MoMA, you know, saying, well, I have these 30,000 photographs and I don't really know where they're from, and can artificial intelligence help me to organize these? And you end up with a very surprising use of technology almost all of the time, because the artist is going to push outside of the bounds of the comfort of the technologist. And it's because you're bringing people together across disciplines that you end up with something that's surprising. But the issue here is you have to value it for what it is. You cannot say this has to go viral, or this has to be, you know, the best artwork ever made by this artist, or this has to be Wayne McGregor's best dance. You know, it has to get the best ever critical reviews because we've designed the entire thing using artificial intelligence. And I think that's where, in any business, you know, we never really have that freedom. We don't give ourselves that freedom because we have to, you know, make our shareholders happy. We have to make ourselves happy, and we have to feel like we've accomplished something that feels meaningful to us already. And that's where I think there's still a space, which hopefully we can have the time and the patience to lean into maybe in the next couple of years, is we live in a very different world. And I don't want to be overly idealistic. You know, there's going to be massive economic uncertainty. People are suffering and struggling in many ways. And, you know, maybe we don't have the freedom and the liberty to lean into experimentation. But if we could allow ourselves the time and the space to say, let us respect one another, even though I'm a scientist and you're an artist, you know, or I'm a technologist and you're a magazine editor, let us respect the space of connecting our ideas around the same issues and where might we end up. And for me, this isn't about a conference. This is about design thinking. This is about building new prototypes for our present, not even the future. And at the end of it, if all that you have is a set of new ideas, I think that's doing something quite powerful, because, you know, we are in a very siloed world. There's many of us, and we think in bubbles, we live in bubbles, where the way we think is in fact more binary probably than ever. And the way that we're educated at any university that I've been familiar with is very binary and very siloed. And I think this is a time to really start to push outside of that.
There's definitely, and then I really like what you said about designing and prototyping for now, not for the moon, not for Mars, in my opinion, but actually for what we're facing, like right here. And I have a question for you as well. Our chat slowly coming to an end, although I think we could have the whole podcast season just talking about those things. We're talking about different people meeting, genres merging in as projects or organizations outside of big tech companies. And I was wondering what your thoughts are around the larger tech companies and what they can do to use technology for a good cause, to be more ethical, more sustainable. Because I think there's a really big conversation around that now too, and the influence of the larger companies. So what can be that on that macro level?
If I might like answer your question on the micro level, is that, you know, the conversations I've recently had with open-ended have been with technologists in who are running their own companies and who are not based in Silicon Valley. Not to say that there's anything wrong with that, but so Esra Al-Shafei has been based in the Middle East for almost her entire life. She has established a series of tech platforms that look at activism through the internet. So everything from an online platform that allowed for voices of dissent to share photos and videos during the Arab Spring at a time when governments were blocking content online. She's one example of a technologist who uses her platform to have positive impact. I just got off a call with a Turkish friend of mine who's based in Istanbul. His name is Sertaj Tashladin, and he started Faladin, which is an app which uses artificial intelligence to generate coffee cup fortunes for people across the Middle East. And so on and so forth. My colleague Tilek Mamutov, who was at Google X, who's now working with entrepreneurs and technologists and computer coders in Central Asia to get them jobs at big tech companies. The reason I list out these people and these names is I think one of the big issues with leaning only on the world's big tech companies for making the world better is that we're then not looking at the diversity of what technology needs to have, which is data and information and users and audiences that are not just in a few countries in the world, and equally coders, developers, technologists, again, who are not just men of a certain ethnicity based in certain parts of the world. And when I was working on emerging markets at Google, you know, often we'd have conversations with our colleagues in California where we'd be like, okay, well, you know, sorry, like the phone, the internet, like, you know, we have to think about buffering on YouTube. And they'd be like, I don't understand. What do you mean? The internet isn't working, you know? And so if you don't have people developing technology and working in the space that are not just in a few parts of the world, you will never have a complete perspective on what does it mean to build for what we call quote unquote better, for more people to be represented, for there to be less bias in data, for there to be less bias in artificial intelligence algorithms, what they spit out at the end of the day. And so that, I think, is step one. And of course, now to answer your question, of course, for tech companies, I think number one, they should be empowering. They should be investing in tech companies, tech startups around the world. They should be investing, as they are now, in supporting entrepreneurs, technologists of different backgrounds, ethnicities, minorities. And finally, and possibly most importantly, is hiring, more diverse engineers, more diverse employees, and empowering employees, no matter what their background, whether they're men, women, whatever their sexuality, whatever their ethnicity, to succeed, to thrive, and to be in positions of leadership. Because again, you know, we all know this. My first job was in investment banking. 50% of my cohort, I think, maybe less, was women. And of course, the number of women at the most senior positions was negligible. And so equally in tech, if we're hiring lots of women and we're creating pipelines for the future, that's not good enough. I think designing for now is what we need to think about. Design systems and structures that allow for minorities, for the less represented parts of these organizations to succeed, to thrive, but also to make decisions. Maybe not everybody will agree with their decisions. Maybe they'll be much more radical than people would have wanted or expected. But that's the only way, I think, to be better employers, but also eventually to be much more impactful organizations. And finally, I do think that, you know, some of the major issues that tech companies have had, everything from the issues we've had with, elections, things like misinformation, things like what we call pseudoscience online, ends up being because you probably do have more siloed thinking. You don't have disagreement in the way that you could or should. And if you don't have real diversity in the people that work at organizations that have so much power, then you're not going to be able to really hear the voices that you need to hear because they're all on the outside. And for me, if those walls start to come down by more individuals that might just disagree coming on the inside, then organizations are going to benefit more than anyone else. And for me, that's really important, is for people to be sitting in the room and to say, I feel very different. I don't agree with you. You know, I wouldn't have used that word. This language, I don't want to use the same word that you're using. I have a different word. I've come from a different culture. I grew up in a different neighborhood. I don't have the same references, but I have the right to have an opinion and to feed into this decision, whether it's a business decision or a product design decision. And for me, that's really powerful. I mean, finally, of course, I think all tech companies have a responsibility to be supporting, you know, movements for social justice, for investing in businesses, in entrepreneurs and individuals, and of course, cultural institutions from around the world, and for thinking about how best to be representative and for using data to do so. You know, this stuff doesn't have to be subjective. You can just say, we want to support, you know, all of Black-owned businesses in a certain neighborhood and whatever, and can we do that, and how can we do that, and equally for culture, how can we be really thoughtful about how we represent culture from outside of the West on platforms like Google Arts and Culture, and maybe not every culture has had an art museum, maybe, you know, that isn't necessarily relevant in every country in the world, fine art or an art museum. But, you know, every culture has had architecture, every culture has had design, every culture has had religion. Some countries have sports as part of their national culture, others have food, fashion, you know. And so how can we be sensitive and thoughtful? And kind of to my earlier point about open-ended, how can we keep stopping to think rather than just saying our goal is to have, you know, to be the best of? What is the best? Where is value coming from? And that can also change over time. And we're living in a time, of course, of very rapid change. We owe it to ourselves to pause and to think. And I think if all tech companies lean into this, it's actually really beautiful and really powerful for all of us.
Thank you, Zuhair. That's such a powerful thought to end our conversation with. And just from, you know, this last kind of 5 minutes, there's so much to be done. There's so much to be done. And I really hope that we'll hear more from you with Open Ended, and that when we can, we'll be able all to meet in person as well and exchange ideas in person, which is something that I've been missing a lot.
Yeah, me too. I think, again, you know, the technology is amazing. Technology is important. But that's what, you know, in teaching architecture students, you know, what is your spatial experience when it's through the lens of technology, which is what my class is, the master's class at Central St. Martin's is about, is how are we experiencing the world today when so much of it is through our phone or our computer or the information being generated by, you know, any number of technologies. And at the end of the day, what really matters to make you happy, right? It's meditation, it's friends, it's feeling community, it's feeling accepted, it's feeling empowered, and it's feeling like you are loved and you belong. And it's not reductive. It applies the same to the most important CEOs in the world today and to, you know, school children. And so I actually think that we're going to have to come back to a world where we are okay being around other people, because that's probably the only way for us to continue to be creative and innovative in the way that will feel meaningful.
I'm sure we all really kind of crave it, longingly looking through the windows of our home offices. And thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Justina. See you hopefully not too far away.
I found it really interesting to listen to Zuhair and for her to share her experience with us of working at Google, working across the globe, also in emerging markets, and really show us the wide spectrum of project she's worked on. And I'm very excited about Open Ended and something that she's doing, the initiative she's doing outside of Google, that actually brings practitioners together for diverse conversations to really start thinking differently and thinking in a way that's potentially is not possible in larger organizations. So I hope you've enjoyed that episode too. And if you did, I'd love you to forward it to a friend, to let somebody know about the podcast and the episode, somebody that you know will enjoy it. What I'm doing in season 5, we're building larger audiences for the podcast. So everything helps, everything you can do helps. I was about to say every little helps and then I stopped and then it didn't sound right anyway. Trying not to use supermarket slogans on a design podcast would be nice, wouldn't it? but yes, if you can share, that helps. And also, if you want to find out more about podcasts, you can head to ondesignpodcast.com. And if you want to follow me on Instagram for a mixture of podcast and some very colorful illustrations, then you can do that at Justina Green on Instagram. And that's all for now. And I look forward to having you join me for the next episode. Bye for now.